Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And Ben.
And John.
And someone else. There he is.
And this week, as we do every week on Superhero Speak, we are going to take a hard, close look at the topics affecting the world today and analyze them in detail for hours. Oh wait, no, this is not that show.
I didn't prepare for that at all.
No, but we are.
Damn, that was the one I was prepared for.
But we are taking a slight left turn this week from our normal show and doing something a little left of center.
Was that a Doctor Who reference? No. Continue.
And instead of talking about
left of center,
instead of talking about our normal Batman, Superman, Spider-Man type stuff, we're going to be talking about a slightly different superhero. And that is Harry Dresden from the Dresden Files. You guys are familiar with that.
Yeah, yeah. The superhero who could actually kill all the rest of them.
Wait, what was that?
He probably could.
What was that, Ben?
I said he's a superhero in his own right.
Yes.
Yes. Now, I want to warn everyone in the audience, if I seem a little bit down on my knowledge ability this time, I did trim the beard of knowledge, and I apologize. I may not be on my A game today, but I'll proceed as best as I can. It's still there, it's just not as long as it once was.
Yes. Many are disappointed.
Yes.
Yes, and I may be broken up because I'm in an undisclosed location again.
Yes.
Where is that, John? Oh, wait.
It's undisclosed. So those who aren't familiar with the Dresden Files, it is a series of books that are
based... Without pictures.
Without pictures, yes. There are lots of words. Written by the author Jim Butcher. And they're about a character named Harry Dresden. And they're... I guess you would call them a noir-style detective-type book.
They're definitely... It's an urban fantasy noir-style series, yes. Has a very hard-boiled detective kind of feel to it. In a modern-day Chicago setting.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's not... When you say noir, don't think black and white and, Dick Tracy. Think more like Gandalf with a shotgun and, in present day.
Right, right. I was going to say, because the twist here is instead of him being a detective, he's a wizard. He's a wizard, Harry. Oh, wait. He is Harry.
Yeah, no, but...
Yes, he's a better wizard named Harry.
And, okay, so the reason that we're talking about this today, for one, we wanted to broaden our topics a little bit, and this is a series that we've all read and loved. They are currently up to, actually, book 15 is coming out later
coming
this
out
month.
At the end of the month.
Yeah, coming out at the end of this month, which is called Skin Game. So we want to talk about some of the characters that we like.
Not what you think.
Some of the plot points that we like from this story. To prepare ourselves for this book that we're all anticipating greatly.
Well, why don't we go over first what we like about it? I mean, there's a reason why we're covering this book in a world where there are so many other series out there that right now are actually, this is like a really kind of renaissance period for urban fantasy and fantasy series. There's a lot of really good ones out there.
Yeah. There are. There's a lot of them popping up. This one definitely, I'd say, rises above the rest. It's the cream of the crop, and here's one of the reasons I feel that it does rise above. As I've tried to read a bunch of other urban fantasy books, and I've read some of them and enjoy some of them, but one of the overarching things that I keep seeing pop up is these tend to have a bit of like a paranormal romance feel in a lot of these books, especially in the ones that center around female characters. And while I'm not saying that there's no romance in the Dresden series, it's definitely not a key feature. They're definitely focused on you know, the key drama around Harry Dresden, around the people around him. They're focusing on the story, and it makes it a much more interesting read than just some sort of will-they-won't-they kind of romantic drama entanglement type stuff.
Well, actually, this makes the Ross and Rachel thing look like a quick tryst. Because there are actually two love interests.
Don't get me wrong. There are a couple love interests in there. There's actually three,
yes,
at least.
Yeah.
Right, but one of the main things I feel that the books really aren't about his love interests. They're about him,
yeah,
and his story.
Right, that stuff is secondary to the story. And what also is interesting with it is, unlike a lot of other romantic themes things, those love interests, while they're there, they don't get in the way of Harry and his friends getting along and working to solve the problem.
Right.
Well, that and the love interests aren't just window dressing for something for him to play off of. He has a seemingly unique ability to basically run this entire world he's created in his own head, and all of these characters have their own lives. It's like the best type of Elder Scrolls you can imagine, where anywhere you go, these characters are living their own lives, have their own plot lines, and just Harry just keeps crossing over them. It's not that everybody just only exists when Harry is there.
Right.
Well, what's also great is that that Jim Butcher, the author, has taken a lot of careful effort to keep the continuity strong. So, like, every time there are these encounters, book by book, things, you know, events unfold and relationships change, and he holds on to those, and he weaves those into the story, and they become part of the continuation of things. And it's really a very rich fantasy world that he's developed that fits nicely on top of the real world we live in.
Right. So to back up a little bit, because you know we're tangenting.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that I love about the series in general, and Jim Butcher as an author, is Jim Butcher was taking a writing class, and the teacher was teaching him, you know, the classic way to build a novel and all the elements that you use and everything that goes into writing a book. And Jim Butcher, you know, swore that you didn't need all that stuff, and it was a horrible idea to follow this formula for writing a book. So he decided he was going to write a novel and prove his teacher wrong. And the next thing you know, the novel that he wrote was the very first Dresden Files. He showed it to
his... Yeah, Stormfront.
Right. Well, actually, it's funny, because it was actually called... let me see, I have it here.
Semi-Automagic.
Yes.
Yes.
That was the original title, and it was changed to Stormfront. But, yes, and it's funny, because... And then his teacher said, oh, you could get this published. You know, and he started shopping it around after that, and you know, the rest is history. It just shows you the kind of mentality that Jim Butcher has. You know, he's I don't know. I guess he has an issue with authority figures, I think.
Oh, he definitely does. I actually have heard several interviews with him, and one of the ones that stuck out was one where he talked about in the early stages of writing Stormfront, he had proposed to his teacher that... Not proposed to his teacher, but proposed in his story of he wanted to introduce this character, have some sort of character that Harry could bounce ideas off of, like some sort of apprentice or something that he could have there, that's or someone else who's knowledgeable, and his teacher was like, well, that's fine, but don't make the character a floating head. And he's like, well, what do you mean? He's like, you don't want it to be a character that comes in and just says, well, you know, Bob, this is this, and basically reveals deus machina type revelation that he needed to know to help him move along. It's just too, you know, it's too easy. You don't want to create that floating head type character that pops in that tells him what he needs to know so he can move the story along. What that inspired Jim Butcher to do was literally create a talking head character, basically this sentient, intelligent spirit that lived in a skull named Bob.
Yes.
Who is by far one of the most interesting characters in the series. next to Harry Dresden himself.
Right, right. But again, he also, he went against what the teacher said, but at the same time, he took the character.
Was careful to take the lesson.
Right. Right.
He took the lesson that he gave, but then also sort of turned it on his head and said, look, I didn't do what you said to do, but I did exactly what you said not to do at the same time.
Right. So, and I do think that when you read the Dresden Files, Harry Dresden is a character who has an issue with authority figures and is bullheaded and has a hard time learning his lessons.
Elsa Freeze.
Huh?
Big surprise there.
Oh. And so I kind of wonder if he, you know, mirrored a lot of his own personality in Harry Dresden. I have to imagine that he did.
I'm sure. I think it's natural for authors to mirror themselves and their characters, especially their leading characters. Though that said, none of his characters are flat. And while you could argue that every character he writes is some aspect of himself, these are fully fleshed characters that I think he's thought through pretty well.
So right. He must be a split personality.
That must be it. I think that's it.
Well, multiple personality disorder.
So, speaking though on the geek credibility of Jim Butcher and his writings, a lot of his books now are actually being turned into graphic novels. So if you are so lazy as to not want to actually read books without pictures, at least Stormfront, and I believe they're working on the graphic novel version of Full Moon by now as well, are available in graphic novel form by now. And they're going
to, as far Ghoul as I know,
they'll continue through the series. Which one?
The Ghoul Goblin.
So, They've done some independent stories as well that are outside of the novelizations themselves. And if you're too lazy for even that, there are audiobook forms for all of these, all read, well, mostly read, by James Marsters, Spike himself, with the exception of Ghost Story, which was the 13th book, which was read by John Glover.
Yes. I have the first comic book that was created was Welcome to the Jungle, which is kind of it's a story that takes place
when Harry, prelude, a prequel.
Yeah, prequel, when he first becomes a detective, a solo detective, or wizard, in Chicago, and he first meets Karen Murphy, who is another main character in the series. And then I have the first collected edition for Stormfront.
Stormfront?
Right. And the interesting thing behind that is, I actually met Jim Butcher at New York Comic Con a few years ago. And I went with my daughter, and she got Stormfront signed, and I got the comic book signed. And what he had said to me when he signed them, he's like, oh, I don't actually get a lot of people asking me to sign these. And he said, the interesting thing is, I always envisioned these stories as comic books. You know, like, it helps me when I think of the stories to picture what everything is, and I've always pictured it, you know, being a comic book, so he was really happy, you know, when he finally got to do the comic book. So, he does have in creative input into how the comic books are done. So, it's another reason to go check them out.
I think there's other things we should mention about this. I mean, there are so many reasons why this author and these books stand out. Like, for the fact that, you know, most of the other authors, they write a couple of books in a series, and that's it, and maybe they'll do other things. Butcher has this entire world running in his head 24/7, apparently. And not only are the books part of this continuity, but not only are the books part of the continuity, but there are short stories littered throughout all these anthologies that are out, most of them edited by P.N. Elrod, that can, all these stories have to do with the continued. There are points in the books where he mentions something, and you find out later, oh, it's in this short story over here, and that's what he was referring to. And the right now, there's going to be 15 books as of May 27th. He's pretty much guaranteed that he's going to write at least 5 more, maybe more, he said, and then there's going to be a 3-book end of the world thing, which is, he claims is going to be completely awesome, which I think is going to happen. So this whole thing, it's going to have a start and an end, unlike Robert Jordan, And it actually is, you know, it there's probably going to be other stories laying around after that. It's really hard to actually collect them all.
Yes.
Yeah, well, he did, it is hard. Although he did do an anthology himself of all the short stories that at least existed at the time, just after the 12th novel Changes, called Side Jobs, which pulls a lot of those together, 15 of them together. But there's like 17 or 18 of those different short stories and novellas that he's written that are scattered in different places. And what's interesting is some of them are from other people's perspectives, other characters in that world. And they have a different voice, they have a different tone to them that fits those characters very well. And that's just, it makes the whole thing even more interesting and more fun.
Yeah, and let's also not forget that as world building goes, there literally doesn't seem to be anything in his books that the only answer, there's nothing where you can ask why and the only answer would be because. This whole world seems to have evolved from his brain, and the system of magic is probably one of the best I've ever seen in any series. The different creatures come from where you'd expect them. They come from ancient history, ancient mythologies, and they all seem to have been completely fleshed out so that there's this whole thing behind them that they act the way they should. He never misses a beat where anything acts out of the way it should. Help me out, guys.
And to that point, like he tackles every single, mythological creature. And like, for instance, he introduces the concept of vampires in his first book in Stormfront. But he doesn't just introduce a variation of vampires. So there's a lot of variations out there. He specifically introduces several versions and gives them, like he said, and I actually heard in another interview with him where he basically said that he's like, there's all these different ideas of what vampires are like. I don't know how to choose which one I want to depict. And then it occurred to him, like, why don't I use all of them? And so he basically designated them as different courts. You know, there's the white court, which are like succubi and incubi that feed off of psychic energy. There's a red court, which are these, monstrous, they can take a totally human form, but then can transform into a monstrous bat creature that drinks blood. And then there's a black court, which is the more traditional, Bram Stoker type, vampires, undead. Corpse-like. Hey, right, and he even, mentions when he talks about this stuff that, Bram Stoker's Dracula wasn't so much a novel as it was a field guide to dealing with these vampires, and it's why you don't see much of them today, because, people took those things to heart and managed to kill a lot of them off. And he does the same thing with everything. Like, in the next book, in Full Moon, he tackles werewolves, and of course, there's not just one type of werewolves. There's six different varieties of werewolves that he addresses in that book, and every single one of them shows up. Like, it starts off with Bob saying, well, there's a bunch of different things that you can categorize as werewolves, and he goes through the list, and of course, Harry has to deal with all of them. And, it's really, really interesting, and he does that throughout with that, and building the Fey world to be this rich and diverse set of beings and having their own sets of rules. And it's really, really quite deep and fascinating.
I'd say it's better than Tolkien. I hate to say it, but I'd say it's better than Tolkien.
I wouldn't go that far.
I'll say it's better than
Tolkien. So I anyway,
I don't know.
One of the things about Butcher that's great is, he sets up this world, and he doesn't. That's another thing is nothing feels thrown in. Everything has a reason and explanation, and but he slowly builds it. He doesn't just throw it all out at once either.
Right, right. He doesn't bombard you with it.
Right. In the first book, he sets up a world where Karen Murphy is a police officer in the Chicago PD who deals with their strange cases. In fact, what's the name? I can't think.
I forget what it's called. But basically, they deal with the paranormal cases.
Right.
And basically, their job is to basically make sure, they deal with these things, they keep them under wraps, and they come up with the, you know, quote-unquote official, special investigations unit is what it's called. They come up with the quote-unquote official story of what has happened in whatever story. Basically, how can we explain this so that people who are not aware of these supernatural things can continue living in their vanilla world and not realize these things are real? You know, come up with that sort of cover story for what happened.
Right. So right away, he's setting up a world where it's this world, it's a regular world, and this stuff goes on, but it's either hidden by the police because the regular public can't accept these strange things. And he even talks about how, like, something weird will happen and people will see it, but then quickly their brains will translate it into, no, that didn't really happen. It must have been just light reflecting off the street or a gas explosion or something like that, you know, and they quickly come up with
they
a logical explanation.
Mentally that it had to be something else.
Right.
Yeah.
And technology is so unreliable when magic is being used that you don't catch it on, you know, electronic surveillance because, you know, somebody throws a fireball and all the electronics is blown out around him.
Right. Well, that's one of the things I always loved about the books, too, is that he can't have technology that because of the magical fields around him cause things to short out, which is why we have the character of Bob, where he needed something that stored all this information. He wasn't going through books. Right. He wasn't going through books. He was getting something that could spit the information back at him and he could crunch the data with, as it were. You know, so his computer is Bob, you know, which I thought was a brilliant move on Peter's part.
I love how he over time, you know, Bob was just basically Bob. He was sort of unexplained for a while until it got to a point where it fit the story to explain that he did have deeper origins, you know, that someone else created him some time ago, and he happened to steal him from his previous master's, you know, study. But essentially, you know, he had nefarious use in the past.
Right. And but then the other thing that was I always found interesting in the first book is they said he then sets up that, you know, it's not just a loose conglomerate of wizards who people who happen to have powers. There's actually a whole society.
The White Council.
The White Council, you know, very much like the Harry Potter, you know, school of magic. There's this council that we don't know about. Ministry of Magic, right. But we also find out that Harry Dresden is also on parole.
Right.
When we are first introduced to him, which was, it was a very interesting concept. But it was go ahead.
I was just saying, so he's operating as a quote unquote wizard in the modern world, but he's sort of, you know, under a watchful thumb. And, you know,
he's under the sword of Damocles.
He basically has essentially a parole officer that comes every once in a while, checks on him, makes sure he's not, you know, breaking, the house arrest that he's under. And doing things he's not supposed to be doing. Right. There's the seven laws of magic, which no wizard is allowed to break, period. But, he specifically is even more restricted, at least initially, until he gets out from under that later in the series.
Right. And, but it was also, I think it was, again, a clever play on Butcher's part, because it introduced us to the higher council and everything that was going on. And it was a reason to explain the rules and why there's the seven rules of magic and setting up what the council is and what they do, you know. And it speaks a lot to Dresden's character as well.
Yeah.
And his issues with authority.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, there's also the fact that Dresden himself, over these books, is not only just growing as a person, but he's accumulating power in several different forms. And so what we're winding up with is basically a very long story told over many books of how somebody like Merlin came to be.
Right. Because definitely Harry in book one versus Harry in even book 12 is a very different power level. You know, he's wielding power, you know, 11 or 12 books in that he would not have even thought to wield, you know, in the early part of things. He grows so much. He learns so much about his capabilities. There's a lot of things that he get introduced that actually amp up his power, in certain stories. And it's really well working together.
Yeah, and not in a Deus Ex Machina way, too. It's not like, oh, look, a fire flower. It's more right. along the lines that basically every time he amps up his power, it's after going through utter freaking right. hell and being beat to crap.
Right, it's a gift and a curse, and a lot of times there's a cost to it.
Right, because he's not going and like reading a book and learning new spells. He's not building up his power that way. It's through events in the books that right. things and happen to him, and he ends up becoming more powerful.
Right, although he is doing that too, because ever since he gained a Molly as an apprentice, he's been boning up on that too. He explains that through like several books, which is why he's starting to be able to create veils and be invisible and stuff. It's because stuff he couldn't do before because he was just unpracticed and he considered it a weak part of his magic and didn't ever develop it. But now that he's got an apprentice who specializes in that, he had to practice too.
Right. No, it definitely. I mean, again, and it shows that the character grows throughout these 15 books. It's not a stagnant, it's the same guy every book, you know?
Yeah. It's not that.
No, not at all. And, so we've talked a lot about the setup. I think people now understand who Harry Dresden is to a point. We mentioned Bob. I think that's everyone's favorite character, by the way.
Probably most people's favorite. Though there's a lot of characters to choose from.
Yeah. And Karen Murphy, obviously, who...
Right, Karen Murphy is great. She's, you know, 5 foot, barely anything, and yet she's tough as nails. You know, a beat cop that really, you know, knows her stuff and doesn't give any leeway for nonsense or, you know, anything.
Right.
It's not just a tough as nails thing. She's working in a man's world, and so she overcompensates. And in overcompensating, she's basically made herself into this kind of little warrior queen who, at one point, takes a chainsaw to a chloro fiend. But you know,
yeah, you gotta do what you gotta do. But also they throw a lot of other. There's a lot of interesting characters here, and I just want to sort of touch on a few. I mean, she's a good one. We also have Thomas Wraith, who is a member of the White Court, and I don't know if I want to spoil any details about it, but he has a closer relationship. I was just saying, he has a closer relationship with Harry than you'd expect.
Well, actually, that happens in years
to figure out how that plays out.
Well, wait, that happens in when do we find that out?
We don't really find that out until
book three.
I don't remember exactly. Probably book three or four, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, and even people close to him, don't know that until much later on.
Right. You're introduced to him in the first book, right? When he has to go to the party.
In the second book.
It's at the party. It was just at the second book.
Second book.
Yeah.
Right.
At the same time you're introduced to the carpenters.
Yes. Right. Yes. That was the same. Was that the second book?
Yeah, well, it was, I'm pretty sure it was the second book. Or was second book Full Moon?
Second book Full Moon.
There's so many of them, you can't keep track anymore. So it's the third book.
It was the third book, in Grave Peril. Yeah. That's where they introduced Michael Carpenter, who is one of the knights, what do they call them?
The Knights of the Cross.
Yeah, the Knights of the Cross. So they sort of touch on religious aspects in this as well, because he's wielding a sword. He's wielding one of three swords that literally have nails of the cross built into them. Nails from Jesus' cross.
Right.
But they have these weird, names, like these sort of fey names, or something like that. But
Amarachius, Fidelachius, and I forget what the third one was. But
they all have, but basically the sword that he's wielding, it's Excalibur. And in each of those names actually has a bit of like Amarachius, I think is essentially
the sword of love.
Sword of love, the sword of faith,
and the sword of hope.
So there's three of them, there are three knights of the cross. And Michael is one of them and ends up teaming up with Harry several times throughout the series of books.
And what's
interesting with these swords is the swords themselves and the people themselves don't actually imbue any specific powers. They're just blessed in a way that their sword in their hands uniquely can They just have really good luck.
It evens the odds.
Right.
It slows the monsters down. It speeds the wielder up. It basically makes it just a test of wills rather than a test of whatever power level each of the combatants is at.
Okay. Right. So I need to point this out. Sure. Actually, all those characters, Thomas Wraith and John Carpenter, are actually introduced in Grave Peril, which is the third book.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah.
That's what we said.
Okay. Just making sure. And that's, right. And then Grave Peril is where he really introduces what the white, black, and red courts are.
Yeah.
Okay. We know in the first book there's the vampires and the red court, but he really explains it in the third book.
Yeah. Yeah, it goes into the different courts and talks about the Uncelia Accords and the Never Never and all those sorts of things.
Right, right. Because not only do we touch on vampires and werewolves, we also deal with the Fae, the fairy creatures, and the fairy creatures he borrowed from other mythologies and in ancient history, where Mab, for those who are familiar with the story of Excalibur and King Arthur, know who Mab is, and she's like the head of the fairies on the summer side. Right.
She's the winter queen.
I'm sorry, the winter.
And she's the winter queen, and you have the winter lady, the winter queen, and the winter mother. And their counterparts on the summer. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, and they get along, but don't like each other.
Right.
Because summer needs winter, and winter needs summer.
Yeah, they're elemental, so it's not they are unchangeable, and they do what they do, and there's no real. It's interesting to see the growth of all the other characters, and on the other side, some of the Fae that you meet in and out, they don't change. They are what they are. They do what they do, even if they know what they're going to do is not the best thing for even them, because it's what they are. He treats them as forces of nature rather than individuals.
The lesson I believe in the Fae is that a tiger doesn't change his stripes. Like, they're based on their instinct, what they've been doing for thousands of years. They can't change. They're stuck in what they're doing, and they keep doing the same cycles over and over again.
Right.
Where humanity can learn from their mistakes and not do the same cycles over and over again.
Well, as the Fae, they're iconic and representative of forces of nature. So they are, as such, they are immutable. And even if they wanted to change, they can't really change. There are individuals at the heart of it, but at the same time, there's sort of a role that they have to play.
Right. And, that was a very, again, he didn't just say, oh, there's fairies, and create his own thing. He based it on something realistic, made it fit into this world that he's created, and it works. And it's, you can't deny that it works in these books.
Yes.
So let's see who else is in the books that we love or don't love.
Well, there's the entire Carpenter family. I mean, Molly and her mother, and actually the sons are starting to come up in the.
Yeah. Well, even you meet the mother in Grave Peril as well, but she sort of becomes Charity. Carpenter's wife becomes a little bit more prevalent through the books. Molly is sort of secondary, but she doesn't really come full-fledged as a major character until
later on.
Changes. It was in Proven Guilty, I think, where there was a plot line that sort of revolved around her a lot. And
it's Proven Guilty. Yeah,
Proven Guilty. Mm-hmm. So
Splatacon.
Which is the eighth book in the series, and that's where she becomes big. And then her brother becomes a much more prevalent character in the last couple books in Ghost Story and Cold Days.
Right.
I throw out other stuff like the Knights of the Black and Daenerys. There's Waldo Butters. Father Bordil.
Yeah, Butters is he's just a mortician, who I don't even remember why Harry actually went to him in the first place, but he basically becomes Harry's sort of de facto practicing doctor. well, even though he typically Murphy operates on him. Dead people. Yeah, I guess it was Murphy.
Well, suggestion. I think he's just introduced in a story where they have to go to the morgue.
Right.
You know,
to look at an odd body. Right. And it just sort of grows from there that he sort of becomes his de facto go-to for any sort of body study type things or figuring out things along those lines, and also his own health needs, because he can't explain what he is or anything to a doctor, so he uses Butters or as his doctor of choice.
Butters is the character in the books that whenever you read a scene with him in it, at least this is how I feel, you can picture exactly who he is, what he looks like, how he's dressed, because there's something about the character that's just alive in the pages, I think. You know,
And usually you picture him like Weird Al Yankovic, because Polka will never die.
Right, right. With big round glasses and like a shorter guy, he's real nerdy.
Yeah, yes. Scrawny and not all that much to him.
Right.
But smart as crap. He's got like, what, his IQ in the book is like 190 or something crazy like that? Guy.
Yes.
But they also utilize that to sort of establish that through his studying Harry, that Harry, as wizards apparently have a heightened healing ability, that higher than humans' right. ability to heal, which one makes him be able to heal from injuries that otherwise other people wouldn't heal from, and two, this is why wizards have significantly longer lifespans than normal mortal humans do. Mm-hmm. They can live for sometimes up to 300 years.
Right.
Or more.
Yes, which has come in convenient for Harry many times.
But it also helps explain, like, that's one of the big problems. It's like the Batman factor, okay? If Batman is really human, there's no way he could go through so many gunshots, so many knife stabs, so many times breaking his leg, breaking his back, whatever, and ever continue after, like, maybe 5 years. He would have the body of a freaking, you know, soldier who'd been through war. Yeah. But this helps explain why Dresden can go through so many adventures and still come out able to walk on his own power.
Right, because not only does his leg bone reset, but it actually heals back together as if it was never broken.
Yeah.
Right. And, all right, so that's Butters. And that's, you know, healing factor.
Father Ford Hill?
Kind of like a slow yes. Wolverine.
He's not Wolverine. He's not Wolverine. He cannot. He heals at the normal human rate. He can just continue to heal to the point where everything's back the way it was.
I think it's slightly faster than a normal.
Father Fourth Hill is another good supporting character, though.
Yeah.
And another one, you know, he just comes off as your typical old school Catholic priest who is very good at helping Harry out in odd situations.
Yeah, but he definitely knows a lot more than you expect the average priest to know about. He's very helpful to Harry off and on throughout the books.
Yeah, I keep wondering if they're going to reveal something about him, you know.
Well, that's the thing with that is it wouldn't surprise me. I hope they don't make it into something weird. But like, there are these characters that we talked about how these characters all have depth. Sometimes there's a level of depth that like keeps you wondering. Like another character along those lines is Mac.
And
who is basically, you're introduced to Mac as he's sort of this bar owner who runs this bar that's tailored towards the supernatural crowd.
Mm-hmm.
That essentially anybody is welcome there from any of the, you know, demons, fae, whoever, can come in there, have a sandwich, have a drink. It's specifically, you know, it's immune to any fights, are not allowed to break out there, because of the Unseelie Accords. And it's funny because some of the things they point out, it's laid out in a specifically haphazard pattern, in that like, there's 13 tables, there's 13 columns, they're not in any uniform order whatsoever, and like all these different weird things about it. And Mac is just a guy who barely talks, stands behind the bar, old grizzled bartender, you know, makes his own, brews his own beer that's supposedly awesome, makes these great steak sandwiches, and is just there in times as a sounding board for Harry when he needs to talk through things.
Right,
but,
right.
In the later end of the series, you find there might be more to him than you realize that there could be.
Yeah, yeah, no. go ahead.
I think we already know who he is, though. I think he's Manannan Mac Lear, so from Irish mythology, who was also a lover of beer and all that. Yeah. So that's actually a character that's fleshed out in not in Harry Dresden series, but in the Iron Druid series. So that's the only reason I figured it out, because there they have that character roaming around, and hey, it's Mac Lear. Hey, his name is Mac. They both like beer. And now we know there's something more to him than just being a vanilla human.
You know, they haven't revealed that yet in the books, and now you've just ruined it for everyone.
No, anybody by this time would probably figure it out.
Yes. Maybe. But that's one of the things I love about Mac as well, is that Harry will come in and talk to him, and Mac doesn't say anything back to him, but Harry just figures out what he needs to do on his own and goes, oh, thanks, Mac, and walks out. You know, it's that kind of relationship.
It's that sounding board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, you know, goes back to the floating head kind of character, but not, you know. You know, it's funny. We also haven't touched on the other main character that was introduced in the first book, which is Susan Rodriguez. Who's a very important character in the Dresden Files.
She turns out to be. She starts out as sort of a nosy reporter who's, writes for a tabloid rag. But, basically sort of interviewing Harry as sort of a fluff piece for her paper. But it ends up getting into a deeper territory. And on one end, she ends up getting in a little over her head with the things that they get involved in. But on the other end, they sort of have a bit of a romance between the two of them.
Right.
Which I'll leave at that.
Well, yeah, I guess so.
Revealable.
I mean, the only thing you could, I don't know. If you want to talk about...
I'll leave it at that.
I was going to say, if you want to talk about another character that's in the books, who really isn't in the books, you'd have to reveal more about her.
Right. I think you just sort of revealed it, Dave. You suck at beating around the bush.
I know. I did it on purpose. Go ahead.
There's also Johnny Marcone. Gentleman Johnny Marcone is a very interesting recurring character.
Right, which is, you know, it takes place in Chicago, so, you know, people associate organized crime with Chicago, and Marcone is the current head of, like, one of the families in Chicago, who doesn't shy away from the idea that there's magic in the world. You know.
Right. He actually ends up starting to embrace it and, starts recruiting people around him who have abilities with the arts.
Right. And
I'm not talking about painting.
No. And it's funny because,
LA.
he describes him as having green eyes, the color of money, and, you know, that's all important kind of stuff within the character, because basically it comes down to, what's good, you know, what's good for him, you know, good for business, good for him. So, like, if Chicago blows up because of some kind of supernatural threat that Harry's dealing with, well, that's not good for business, and he won't make money. So he has to help out Harry every once in a while.
But there's more to Marconi than meets the eye, too. He's got a whole history and a secret, and there's a lot more to why he's doing what he's doing, not just profit. But that hasn't been revealed yet. But you gotta kind of get a feeling for it.
Right. And we also forgot to mention the best two characters in the whole book.
Are you talking about his fairy godmother?
What? No, not his fairy godmother.
No,
we won't get to her yet.
Mouse and Mister.
Yes.
His dog and his cat.
So the story would not be complete without our furry brethren. So he's got a cat named Mister who basically, you know, comes and goes as he pleases and has no truck with anything he doesn't want to deal with.
He's a 30-pound house cat.
Right. Who basically doesn't take any crap from anyone.
Right.
And we don't know if he's special yet or not. All we know is that he's always at the house and is and sometimes gives Bob a ride-along.
Right. But Mouse, on the other hand...
Mouse, on the other hand, starts off as a puppy that we get introduced to as in one of the stories.
Was that in Grace?
Just
was that in the beginning of the third book?
No, it was,
that was the fourth or
Deadbeat.
Fifth book.
It was in Deadbeat.
It was Deadbeat, yes, you're right.
Yes.
Yes, he's running out of a building, being chased by a creature, and he has a box of puppies with him.
Right.
Just
right.
Say it was a giant monkey throwing flaming poo. I mean,
there is that.
See, you get all mythologies in this series, and that one happened to be from, you know, Tibet. So
yes, and he jumps in his car, and they are what kind of Tibetan Mastiffs?
Yeah, Mastiff. And actually, I misspoke. He was introduced in Blood Rites.
Okay.
Which was the sixth book. But then was, you saw him grow up in Deadbeat.
Right.
Because
right.
it was a batch of puppies in that one, and he managed to not get handed over when they returned the puppies, what he sort of stowed away. But yeah, he's, I was just reading the page where it said what he was.
Well, he was like the runt of the litter too. And they were these,
he was,
these Tibetan temple dogs that protected a temple in Tibet, and he was the runt. So they were like, basically at the end, the monk was like, oh, you know, you can keep him. And, he grew up.
Yeah.
And he's a big dog.
And we learned that he's not just a dog. Yeah.
Yes. There's definitely more to Mouse than meets the eye. He's, as it is, throughout the books, he definitely seems to show a heightened awareness to things, like awareness of the supernatural, but also just an understanding of what Harry's asking him or needs of him more than a normal dog would. And there's even some supernatural people who approach him with apprehension, saying that's not a dog, you know, that's a that's a foo dog, you know,
right.
and things like that. And you do find out more about him later on, and that he is a lot smarter than he even appears to be.
Yes.
Specifically in Changes, I liked some of that. His portrayal in that book was great.
Right, right. Or Ghost Story. I loved him in Ghost Story. Because he was one of the only ones that could, you know, see a certain character.
Yeah, and we won't, yes, we won't. There's a lot. Yeah, for those of you, just so that our listeners know, so the first nine books kind of follow the, because Harry Dresden does actually have his PI license, and so it does kind of follow the, he's a PI, he's dealing with more mundane matters, although it starts to get into a lot of politics with the White Court, the White Council, and all this other stuff, but Changes is a Changes is like the start.
Changes
of the
is well titled.
Half. Yes, it's and the it, start and of the well second titled. Half. And
yeah,
right, right. In
it's,
fact,
it's if, definitely a game changer.
In fact, Changes and Ghost Story, which are the 10th and the 11th book, both books are actually kind of short.
12th and 13th, actually.
12th and 13th. Okay, so you get the feeling that they were written as one story and then broken into two different books because they're really two parts of the same story, you know.
Well,
but,
you could say that about all of the books. There are many arcs to each of the books, but it's all about Harry's life, and it all flows together very well.
Right.
Yeah, but those two books are special. I mean, that basically they're signaling, okay, now kindergarten's done. Now we're going to put our big point pants on and start dealing with some real bad stuff.
Right.
Right.
Yes. And yes, before we get into his fairy godmother, there is one other character.
The fact that he has a fairy godmother is interesting enough.
Yes, yes. There is another character in the books, that goes along the lines with Mr. and Mouse, is his car.
Ah, the Blue Beetle.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. what I love about the Blue Beetle, it's, first of all, it's well established from the very first book that Harry Dresden is not short. He towers over most people at just, not far from 7 feet, you know, 6 foot something. And he drives around a classic Volkswagen Beetle that he's nicknamed the Blue Beetle as a comic book reference. But very little of it is actually blue, if it ever was blue to begin with, because he keeps constantly having to replace and repair it. And he seems to have found a magical mechanic that can always seem to get it back on its feet, no matter what happens to it.
Right. Right, and it's funny too, because you just mentioned that, yes, he calls it the Blue Beetle to the you know, reference to the DC comic book character. And that's an important fact to point out about these books as well. And something about
Jim Butcher. There's a lot of geek references.
There's
in these
a
books.
Lot of geek references in all the books. In fact,
and Star Wars,
right. Star Wars, Star Trek, comic books. It's all over the place, and it's always hilarious because it's usually coming from Harry. It's usually in the context of him dealing with monsters who have no idea what he's talking about.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. There's even a reference to aliens. You know what book that is? Come on, you guys couldn't have missed that.
I'm sure I remember. I'm Splattercon. Sure I caught it at the time.
Splattercon.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
What? One yeah. of the ones he fights.
Xenomorph. I'm going to be.
I'm going to. Okay. Yeah. Well. Yeah. One of the phages that comes through as an alien.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Like I said, I probably caught it at the time, but that was 10 books ago.
So. Right. Right. But yeah, it's like his apprentice Molly. We haven't gone into too much yet, other than she's one of John Carpenter's
Michael
Carpenter's daughters.
Daughters.
Not the movie.
Not
maker.
The horror writer.
Right. But whenever he's dealing with her, a lot of times there's a lot of Yoda, Luke Skywalker references that go on in those. You know, so a lot of Star Wars. Yeah. So again, if you're a nerd, you'll enjoy these books. So John, you seem like you really wanted to talk about his fairy godmother.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's not a fairy godmother the way anybody who's listening to this is thinking.
Right.
She is a fairy. She is the Lanantia. She's basically a fairy godmother with shark teeth and the impulse to save Harry by turning him into a dog and keeping him next to her forever and ever and ever. And
what's wrong with that?
Because of the way things with fairies work, promises were made by Harry's mother, and who is no longer around for reasons you'll have to read about, and by Harry himself, and there are favors exchanged, and she becomes more and more important as the books go along. But she's not the kind of fairy godmother that helps, because when you're dealing with a fairy, I'm gonna quote Robert Asprin here. When you're finished dealing with a fairy and you think you got the best of the deal, first count your fingers, then your toes, then your relatives.
Right, right. No, and that's an important thing to point out. Oh, go ahead.
I was just gonna say it's really interesting how a creature that cannot lie can be so deceptive. As the Fae can be, and City definitely.
Yeah, am I the only one who thinks that if they ever played Dungeons and Dragons with Jim Butcher, that if he ever gave you a wish, you would never use it?
Well, if he was the Dungeon Master, yes. No, but I mean, that's an important thing to point out about these books too, is that, like we've mentioned, the White Council, the White Court, the Red Court, the fairies, is that within each of these, he has built a system, a rule system, a society that, and then these societies have to abide by these rules that they have, you know, right. which is funny because it's like human society. We have rules that we live within, to a point, but right. So that's one of the things. The fairies can't lie, but they trade.
They can be very manipulative.
Very manipulative. Mm-hmm. They trade favors and promises like money. Basically, and you don't ever want to owe a fairy something. Ever.
Yes.
Period. Don't ever ask them for something, because you don't want to owe them anything. So, this is an important rule of life, people. I'm going to say it one more time. Yeah. Don't ever ask a fairy for anything, because you don't want to owe them anything.
Yeah.
So, yes. He has a fairy godmother who actually is a fairy. Like, that's, again, best way to describe this series.
Well, she's a fairy godmother because she is a fairy, and she's his godmother.
Right.
She was involved with his mother, which is how she became his godmother, and there's a whole story behind that too.
Yeah. And something else I want to point out. Now, see, everyone here has listened to us for the last hour,
It's been an hour.
Talk about this series, and you can hear how passionate we are about it. We love it. Which brings us, you know, makes you go, oh, wow, maybe they should turn this into a TV series. Well,
yeah, they did.
Well, boys and girls, they did.
They tried to.
They tried to.
Now, granted, they did it when there were very much fewer books written. So I'll give them some latitude for that, but it just did not. Television editorialism just took too much, made too many cuts. Well, and it just wasn't the same thing.
Right.
Well, it was also when sci-fi became sci-fi, and they were changing their lineup, and I think that got cut because it was not what the new version of sci-fi thought they were going to be or whatever. I don't know.
Well, hold on. The first thing is, like, one thing we didn't talk about, Harry wears a leather duster. Mm-hmm. You know, and one of the important things about this leather, it's not just that it looks cool, because when you picture a guy walking around with a leather duster on, it's kind of cool. But it's also, he imbues it with spells to protect him from bolt gunshots and whatnot.
Right.
So when they cast, when they put together the TV show, one of the first things they got rid of was the leather duster. He has a leather jacket. It's not quite the same, you know?
Not quite, yeah.
I also want to point out the actor who played Harry Dresden is, on Arrow.
He is now, yes. He is
Paul Blackthorne.
Right.
Yeah, Paul Blackthorne, and he plays the detective who's Laurel Lance's father.
So right.
Detective Lance.
And Black Canary's father. But anyway.
And Joanne Kelly was also on it as Bianca, and she has been doing Warehouse 13
Yes.
Right. So before we get into all that, then we all talked about the Beetle, and we love the Beetle. It's a cool, like, he made it a character. Well, they turned it into a Jeep.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
argument being that, oh, it was easier to film.
He couldn't fit. No, he actually said that, like, they tried to use a Beetle, and he couldn't fit into it. His legs were too long, and it just didn't work. But there was a logistics problem. It was cumbersome for him to get in and out of that car. So they switched it to a Jeep because he could get in and out of that easier. But yeah, there was a lot of departures from the novels that sort of put a sour taste in fans' mouths. Now I'll admit, when the show came on, I watched it. And not having read any of the books at the time, I loved it. And then I read the books, and now I see why everybody else who was a fan didn't like it.
So
yeah.
So I invite everyone who is listening to this episode, and if you've read the books and you're not familiar with the TV series, because I've actually met quite a few people who have read the books and never knew they made a TV series. Look up on YouTube. First look up when they announced the series. And you see Jim Butcher there sitting with, is Blackthorne?
Yeah, Paul Blackthorne.
Paul Blackthorne talking about the series. Oh, here's our Harry Dresden. He, you know, so excited about it. Blah, 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 blah. And then go and find the video where after the show got canceled, and it was either right before the rights got back to him or right after the show got canceled, and it's Jim Butcher saying, yeah, I'm really sorry about it. It's, you know, once I have the rights back, I'll figure out what the next thing I can do with it, you know. Just, you know, funny how, you know, yeah, when the show was on and getting made, yeah, he's got to love it. He's got to promote it, but then...
Of course.
Once it gets canceled, he can tell the truth.
Yeah. And I'm sure he had a hand in a lot of it. But it was the death of a thousand cuts. Like, he had to make compromises, you know, in his editorial role with the show. I understand how it happens, but at the same time, it sucks that it happened that way. Honestly, if they were ever to readdress this in the form of some sort of video media, I think there's only two ways to go about it. You either do them as movies, where you treat each book as a film, or you do a premium channel TV show Game of Thrones-esque, where you can, but I say you go more along the style of like Sherlock, where you have long episodes, where each episode covers a book, or you split it into two episodes or something like that, where you can tell the story of those books either in the course of a season or over the course of one or two episodes, and really treat it well and cover the whole breadth of the story.
Yes, I think, I definitely think, now especially because he has said he's going to end at 20 books. The 15th book is coming out, May 27th.
He'll end after 23 books. There's going to be 20 books plus some others if he comes up with really good ideas, and then he'll have the 3-book Armageddon series. Okay.
So, but this would be the time to start it, because
By the time you catch up,
he'll be near the end of the series. Coming towards the end. Right. And you could have it all tie in together and be beautiful and wonderful and make everyone happy.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, and then you can start on Ilona Andrews, but that'll be another.
So.
That's a conversation for another day.
So, yes.
He also wrote some other good books, just to point out that he has a secondary series that he put out a number of years ago. That's a pure fantasy series called The Codex Alera, which was a great book and the result of a bet. And he's working on a new series that has yet to have any issues published yet. That is a steampunk trilogy called Cinder Spires.
Right. But I think the other thing we need to point out that also ties him in with this show even better.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what you're about to mention, Dave.
I'm trying to remember the name of it.
The Darkest Hours.
He wrote a book called The Darkest Hours, which is a novelization of a Spider-Man story.
Yes.
And if you listen to this episode and you don't pick up any of the Dresden Files and you don't pick up the Codex Alera or anything else Jim Butcher picked up, pick up The Darkest Hours for one reason. You are going to read a novelization of the character Rhino that will blow your mind away.
Right. Much better than the version they just put in The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And it's a great characterization of Peter Parker as well.
Yes. But it'll make you feel sympathy for Rhino. It'll make you love the character that you never cared about before. It's a must read for any Spider-Man fan. I can't say that enough. So.
Yeah.
So, before we wrap up, you guys have anything else you want to add?
No. Just, no. Jim Butcher for life.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, boys and girls, as always, don't let your duster get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Yeah, yes.
Speaking of capes, you can tug on ours by joining the conversation on Facebook, Twitter, or Google+ at Superhero Speak. If you have any comments on my bad jokes, you can email me at dave@superheroespeak.com.
You can also subscribe to our podcast through iTunes, Stitcher, and various other channels. Or if you'd like to tease the beard of knowledge, you can email me at ben@superheroespeak.com.
We also occasionally rant about things on our website, superheroespeak.com. Or, if you'd like to further discuss the prowess of Rainbow Dash versus anybody in the greater geek universe, you can email me at john@superheroespeak.com.
And don't forget to check out our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. companion show, Agents of Speak, which you can watch live most Tuesdays around 9 p.m. on our Google+ page, or archived on our YouTube channel. Now let go of our cape.